You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of October 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
Our intelligence community just came out and said in the last few days that the Kremlin, meaning Putin and the Russian government, are directing the attacks, the hacking on American accounts to influence our election.
As the third and final US presidential debate looms ever nearer, we'll look at what Hillary Clinton might need to do if she's to take full advantage of a limping Donald Trump. Also ahead...
If we don't get control of our borders, we're going to have domestic civil war in this country. We're going to have terrorism, people blowing up buses and things like that and killing people.
They might sound like a wacky bunch, but do we really understand what's driving Trump's voter base? And if not, could they come back even angrier next time? All that plus Iraq's fight to take back the city of Mosul. And would you holiday in a place that's mostly cold and wet with just 4 hours of daily sunshine? Welcome to Iceland. That's all today on Midori House, live from London with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are the journalist and broadcaster Michael Goldfarb and Robert Fox, the defence editor of the London Evening Standard. First, to Iraq, where the battle to retake the city of Mosul from Islamic State is underway. Strategically speaking, it is one of the most important missions since the US-led invasion of Iraq back in 2003. But despite efforts to establish the defeat of ISIS as a common cause, many of the forces targeting the group remain enemies of each other, complicating the already mammoth task ahead, which may yet determine the future of Iraq as a united entity. Robert Fox, when you look at all the different groups involved, from obviously the US in some way to the Kurdish Peshmerga to the Sunni forces and the mainly Shia Iraqi army, one wonders what happens afterwards.
You must wonder because of the nature of Mosul and indeed of its twin northern hub of Kirkuk, because as you hint, they are extremely mixed. And they're mixed in a way, even now, even still, that we're not getting. I mean, who is remembering the Turkmen, who have caused trouble there? You get very violent minority Christian groups. We've seen things with the Yazidis, who often have a religion which goes way beyond Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. And this is not hypothetical. This is not academic table talk. There have been bad fights, particularly in Mosul, but also in Kirkuk, continuously since it was the seat of Turkish beys and Iraq came into being in the 1920s. This is what the public is not being reminded enough, because the second proposition in your question is absolutely right. A lot of the credibility of the whole botched and quite often mistaken American-British-led initially enterprise in Iraq since 2003 hangs on this. You're quite right. They are trying to restore credibility from this. And you're right, too, in suggesting that the ability of Iraq to hang together as a unified nation of some kind or a unified nation state really might well depend on this.
Michael Goldfarb, I've been slightly concerned by some of the coverage of this. There was one report last night on a big station which referred to this as close to a good versus evil fight as you can get. Now, without wishing to say, to try and find positives in ISIS, because there aren't any, my concern more is the good guys aren't necessarily all good, are they?
Well, to pick up on what Robert was saying, everybody has their own agenda, and it is a test of whether these agendas can be molded together in a proper mosaic so Iraq can continue to cohere. I don't know in this initial phase whether it can be anything other than good guys versus bad guys. The reports, I mean, I've been to Mosul. I have Kurdish friends who are in the press wagon behind the Peshmerga in these early days of comparatively easy fighting. And there are, I don't know how they do this. They exist in Raqqa as well, which is the real de facto capital of what is still called Islamic State. You know, there are people who are getting online access, pumping out information at great personal risk. And, you know, yesterday, the reports already coming in. ISIS is summarily executing people who they've held in prison and so on. I think that in the initial phases, which could be months, this initial phase until they're really pushed out, there really are primarily good guys. And we'll see if it disintegrates, as has happened in earlier attempts to push ISIS out of places like Fallujah and Ramadi and Tikrit, where there was a fair amount of revenge killing going on. And then we say, oh, well, nobody wears the white hat here. But I think in these first 60 days or so that it takes to get inside the city, we have to think that there are guys in white hats.
Just 2 points quickly, Steve. One is that I follow Michael entirely, but I am disturbed by the Manichaean terms. By that I mean black-white terms, the end of things, in which the Americans and the Brits have gone along with them. Look where the BBC is now. The way they have so set up this narrative, the way that they've embedded people with the forces coming up from the south, in inverted commas, Iraqi army. As we have said, that is much more complicated than this. And we know the really difficult part, assuming they will get there, and I think they will, once they get into the core, and they're nowhere near this, the core of the conurbation of Mosul, which I've visited too, like Michael, it's what you're going to do with the occupation force, which went so badly wrong with Tikrit and the other places. And because the Shias and the Sunnis started fighting. The Shias were from the south, and we've got the same elements this time. They say they have prepared a separate force of 15,000 to do the occupation of Mosul. But I think time is running out.
You hear them say, oh, well, the Peshmerga come to here, and then they're going to stop. And
Peshmerga have never stopped, by the way, because there's also a sense of Kurdish nationhood. It's very complicated, which has been going on since they felt they were cheated in the Treaty of Sèvres in 1924. So they are not going to pull back. They want a bit of Mosul. Haider al-Abadi government in Baghdad thinks that they don't, God, we're kidding ourselves.
In the years immediately after the occupation, a kind of ethnic disintegration happened, and the Kurds went to the east bank of the Tigris River, which flows through Mosul. And I think that they certainly want to take back those neighborhoods, and it'd be hard to dislodge them from there. I mean, I think that what you'll see, you know, what. There's another element in this. Saddam was overthrown, but significant numbers of senior Ba'ath Party figures remain loyal to an idea of their own power from those days. And many of them actually became Islamist because that was the available political vehicle for them to maintain. And Mosul was the headquarters. Particularly of Iraq, for whatever reason, many, many members of the general staff in Saddam's army, who were just below the level of being in the deck of cards, come from Mosul. They have power bases of tribe in Mosul. It will not be as easy as all that, although my guess is they will make it very easy for ISIS to get out and go to Syria because they don't want the city destroyed. And just to come back on white hats, I don't see barrel bombs being dropped on any civilian quarter in Mosul, as we see barrel bombs and chlorine being dropped on civilian quarters in Aleppo.
I'm sorry, I don't want to sound cute, Michael. The Americans did announce they were using thermobaric, which is air fuel thing, initially. We need it to break into the bunker system, which I found was strange. The other point I'd like to make, Steve, which is a very, very strong part of the narrative now, is the atomization of Sunni governance through tribe. The tribes are breaking up. There was an observation of very, very clear first-hand piece that had been going through Sunnistan, as it were, saying that you're now getting subgroups of just 100 people electing or selecting in a very Arab conciliar way. It's part of Arab culture, right, even from the Atlantic, from Morocco through, that you get together. It's sort of rather like a shura in Afghanistan, and you elect your sheikh. Your sheikh is your military leader and your spiritual leader. These are now tiny, tiny groups. And how they're going to get that to cohere, I would like to actually criticize the Obama administration for this. I think they've been much too casual and they've been much too tardy about it. And it's not surprising that this has come in Mosul at the end, in the dying weeks of the Obama presidency. Boy, whoever comes in has got to stick with this one, because I do follow the argument of my friend Patrick Coburn of The Independent that this is the swing issue, but also the whole future of the Arab world at the moment, currently as conceived, is going to swing on the fate of Iraq, more than Syria, more than what's going on in Saudi Arabia and Yemen. These are really high stakes.
Michael, I want to look at what happens next for ISIS, because even as people say, well, look, this would be a defeat for them if and when they lose Mosul, there is a general acceptance that ISIS remains strong enough to do damage and to still be influential. But there is a lot of talk about how it is a predominantly Iraqi-led organization. And if actually everyone has to flee through that corridor from Mosul into Syria, whether that changes the nature of the group. What do you make of that?
Well, just step back. People listening, you know, it's like if you have a ball of mercury and you stick your finger on it, it goes out into 1,000 little globules, and then it comes back together in a different way. And I think that this extreme jihadism, Salafism, Wahhabism, you know, whatever people are calling it, you have to remember how ISIS came about. ISIS grew out of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Al-Qaeda in Iraq grew out of Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda was a Saudi grew out of, you know, the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. There is this extremely violent minority that draws in people from all over the Muslim world. And when they're chased out of Afghanistan, they turn up in Iraq. And when they're chased out of Iraq, they morph into ISIS. When you say, I do think that it is entirely probable that ISIS will be chased out of Mosul, they'll be bombed out of Iraq. Al-Baghdadi will die in the same way that his predecessors have died. You know, bin Laden died who was the Palestinian Jordanian who ran
Zarqawi.
Yeah, Zarqawi died. Thank you, Robert. I'm old. I'm so old. I forget these names. He will die in the same way. It doesn't matter. Somewhere out there, there's a 30-year-old who's been fighting with him, who's already left the area. Maybe he's in Libya. Maybe he's in the Sahara somewhere. He will gather 10,000 to make trouble somewhere else. And this will continue and continue until the big picture, civil war within the Arab Muslim world, ends. And when it does, then this kind of stuff will stop. But really, you know, I mean, sometimes I think people forget, maybe Robert may have a different view. I think sometimes we are guilty of Orientalism, and we think it's we do this and they do that.
Exactly.
And we don't realize that within the community, if there was no interference from the West, there'd still be a civil war going on.
I absolutely follow what Michael says, because this operates in many dimensions. He's quite right. A lot of the leadership is good old Ba'ath military leadership, converted, radicalized. Some of it certainly seems to have happened under extreme duress in detention in Abu Ghraib. I'd like to say I think more of that is going to survive. I think they will go out of Mosul, but I think they'll take to the mountains. And I'd like to put in a third party there that we haven't mentioned yet, and that kind of thing could be very dangerous for them. We see the two prime international sponsors of the US and Russia. This is really bad news for Russia, because they're still drawing in Chechens, Ingush, and And we know that area of the Caucasus is a big training ground for this. So we will still get the military dimension, but in a different way, in a different form, and with a different leadership. But what I think is very difficult to track is the way the franchise works, precisely as Michael has described it. Because, yes, this element seemed to be kicked out of Afghanistan, and Afghani fighters started appearing in bits of Algeria and Tunisia, as well as, to a lesser extent, where the current regime, the Sisi regime of Egypt, thought that they had got on top and contained the al-Qaeda element in Sinai. They're resurgent again. They're not defeated in Libya, despite what we've been led to believe. So you're going to get local around Iraq, where they will draw in and think of something else. There will be a regional war, but the bit I can't get any indication of is the virtual war, and I think that that will continue because they're so good at it. They're so good at proselytizing. They're so good at this parallel world in virtual space, in social media, and they, as we know, it tells you a completely different story, and that is where it is pan-Islam. That's why the jihadi slash, and they are slightly different, but they're like two sides of a seed, the Salafi element and the jihadi element. It is still powerful and potent, but we haven't seen manifestations of that that are very obvious in Europe, for example, recently, in recent months. But it doesn't mean it's gone away.
Michael, there is a public story that the US administration and its Western allies will tell here, which is that we have helped to drive ISIS out of Mosul. We are taking the fight to ISIS in Syria. And they'll be able to point to things that you can, you know, that many people can look at and nod their heads and go, yeah, okay, actually,
defeat in the south of Syria, for example.
This has happened here, and that's happened there. But as away from that public discussion, do you think there is that more expansive private discussion that you were talking about just then happening within the State Department, within the Pentagon, of, okay, it's all very well as saying we've had these what look like successes, but there's a bigger picture here of how we deal with ISIS and the idea behind it that we're not getting to grips with yet?
Oh, that's a very difficult question. One, because I'm here and not in Washington. And I tend to think that in these last weeks, I actually thought they would. I know why they're doing it now, because they have bad weather in northern Iraq and they have to get fighting and get stuck in now. I actually thought they'd wait till after the election, because if there's a catastrophe, if they begin to bog down, and let's be clear, they are nowhere near being where the heavy fighting is yet. What we're reading about, mostly the Kurds, the Kurdish Peshmerga, are taking back the villages they ran away from 2 years ago.
And they're going through them remarkably quickly.
Yeah, I mean, they ran away remarkably quickly, and I'm not entirely sure they were under threat. They did it, I think, because they wanted to call attention to their plight and get maybe some more weaponry out of the West. I think that in America right now, at the in the dog days of the Obama administration, and we'll talk about this in a minute, I know, in the likely onset of the Clinton administration, I think people really are worried about managing other things. They're worried about managing NATO. How do you, I mean, I thought Robert was going to mention Turkey when he was in his long explanation.
Well, the regionals are very important, Turkey and Iran particularly.
I mean, I think Turkey, the relationship with Turkey has to be, so, I mean, this is a NATO ally. How do you manage Russia when, you know, it's pushing back against NATO up in the Baltics and in the Ukraine? So I think that these are questions that would occupy State Department people rather than big picture on ISIS. If they're smart, they'll say it's still pretty localized. There are no more than, what do you think, Robert? How many tens of thousands of fighters are really with ISIS? 30, 40, 50?
30 throughout that region.
Yeah. So what is the
maximum 30?
I mean, when you've got to manage the relationship with Turkey, manage the Putin relationship, if you're in the State Department at a senior level of analysis, I think you're saying we'll deal with ISIS in good time.
I'll be quite quick.
Let's talk briefly about Turkey then.
Turkey is very important. It's the linchpin. It's the linchpin actually in both crises, and they are absolutely twinned, Iraq and Syria. And they've got to cut a deal with Turkey. And the thing that's got to emerge, we've got various hints about what's gone on between Erdogan and Putin, but they're not going to resolve Aleppo and what's going to take place, because you're going to have Kurdish enclaves. Sorry, bad news for the Turks there, and bad news for Assad, and bad news for the Russians. It's got to happen in that way. But I want to ask you a big question. I follow exactly what Michael is saying. If over this side of the Atlantic is anything to go by, the thinking is far too stovepiped. They do one thing at a time, one thing at a time, one thing at a time. Look, we are at big tipping points with big issues that we've all talked about and written about, and passionately so in some cases. Things like climate change are really kicking in that region. They've gone past a tipping point where, you know, Kuwaiti schools have had to be closed in term time because it's simply too hot. Temperatures 60 degrees in Baghdad and the central Iraq plain. These are big changes. And this is where the increasingly isolationist British government under Theresa May, and even for all his urbanity and internationalism, I just don't think the Obama administration has paid enough attention, because it's the odd people that you and I know very well, and good for them for putting in their effort on this, people like David Kilcullen. But David Kilcullen is somebody who's worked as an officer on the ground and as an analyst both in Afghanistan and Iraq. But he is almost a voice crying in the wilderness, because he looks at the micro and then throws it against the screen of the big picture. And that big picture is darkening a lot at the moment, as you know, people like Paul Rogers, who comes on your shows a lot from the Peace Institute at Bradford. But there is no traction with this in government at the moment.
Okay, let's move on to the next government in America. Michael, you mentioned the incoming Clinton administration, and if you take a look at the New York Times forecast, which I know you do religiously several times a day.
I promise you my Samsung J5 is on silent. I'm looking at the 538.
You're not going to blow up, are you, Michael?
No, that's the S7. Even Nate Silver, who's slightly more conservative than the New York Times, you know, shows Hillary Clinton on a chance of winning at 87.6%, and he called every state in the last election correctly. So, yeah, I mean,
so we've got this debate tonight in Las Vegas. If you are Hillary Clinton, this is quite a hard debate to win, isn't it, Michael Goldfarb? Because, you know, everyone expects her to win. Everyone expects Donald Trump to, you know, to hold it together 15 minutes and then lose his cool, to maybe sort of stalk her around the stage like he did last time, or maybe sort of go off on a tangent criticising Rosie O'Donnell. You know, she is expected to win here. What should she be doing tonight?
Well, first of all, it's interesting. I've just come back because I'm making a radio documentary, the third one I've made this year, about this insane election season. And, you know, we speak in terms of winning and losing. But the thing is, if Hillary's supporters think she won, it'll be in their newspapers. But they will not be read by the Trump supporters, who will be listening to right-wing talk radio, who will tell them, no, Trump won. So in a sense, it doesn't matter. It's like, because here you have to go from metaphor. I mean, when Arsenal kick off shortly against Ludogorets, you know, we will know at the end of 90 minutes, I hope, that Arsenal have won. You know, this is what we Robert's laughing. This is what we live for. But, you know, this is all metaphorical. Anyway, but look, I think that what she should do to seal the deal, absolutely seal the deal, is no matter what Trump is throwing at her, try and drag her answers around to actually articulating some policy. We're so deep into this election, and they're critical issues. Now, she's been burned. I mean, Robert was talking about climate change. I mean, climate change is real, and it should be out front in this election, because policy needs to be developed and needs to get some kind of consensus. And you need to break the Republican strangle, because it's a party of climate change deniers. She tried this and nearly killed herself. She said at a town meeting, we're going to have to move to clean energy. We're going to put coal miners and coal businesses out, but we have to take care of our people. They did the hard work. This is what she said. They did the hard work. They risked their lives, and we need to make sure they have new jobs. Well, the soundbite didn't include that last bit. It just said we're going to put coal miners out of work. And I've just come back from a coal mining region, and I tell you, they'll never vote Democrat again. And it's an astonishing thing. The American society has become so incredibly immature. And I'm an American, obviously. It is an immature, regressive, it's in a terrible place. I interviewed someone who said, people have forgotten their citizenly duty. One of the keys to that is, you live in a free society. There are no secret police. Use your brain to the best of your ability to rationally think about the problems in society. Nobody is doing that. She's got a solid lead. Tonight, she can seal the deal by answering questions about policy seriously and not worrying about whether the soundbite that comes out of the answer is going to be negative or not.
She mustn't fall into any of his traps, which will be emotional. I don't know whether he's going to accuse her of being on drugs, but something like that will come out of the box.
Too weird, though?
Yeah, yeah. But she's got to ride it. And Michael is absolutely right, because all the commentary of the... It's not just I read the papers that I like, but it's good analysis. I've heard a lot of good analysis on Monocle. I read The Economist. I read the Financial Times. And the consensus, and there is a consensus, she has to continue to sound like a grown-up and a grown-up politician that is going to tackle policy. Yes, she won't have the complete answer, but she will have to say what her agenda is. And I think that she will win through, but she mustn't lose her nerve and she mustn't lose her temper. And we all have tempers, and Hillary has quite a temper too, because his behavior is quite extraordinary. Because I really wanted to ask Michael at some time, I think I was musing him, is Trump's campaign a huge joke? Is he what he really playing? Is he playing to the gallery to step himself up several gears in his career as an infotainer? Is it going to push him forward to be a global figure, buying out Fox News, trying to sort of kick CNN into the long grass?
I think we try and see a strategy where there is none.
The mind naturally wants to impose some kind of order.
Yeah.
I mean, even when you're tripping on LSD, you try and put things in front.
There is one question, Mike, I want to ask you about Trump, which is, and I wish I could credit the person who came up with this phrase, but they said that the problem with understanding Trump is that people in the media, people like us, take his words literally, but they don't take him seriously. Whereas his supporters take him seriously, but they don't take him literally.
Oh, you know, that's a very good. That's a very clever.
It's not mine. It's someone else's.
It's really good.
Because virtually every conversation I've had, except a couple with some older folks last week in Pennsylvania, you think, Trump supporters are knuckle dragging, Nazis, KKK members, and so on. No, they are business people, they are well-educated, and they look at him in precisely this way. And I think, the oversensitivities, when he talks about political correctness, he plays on that. The oversensitivity, he made a sexist comment. In a lot of places in America, there's still sexual banter, and that's how they hear it. And they don't believe he's going to build a wall, because they know that 1,200-mile wall is not going to be built unless you're an emperor of China 3,000 years ago. And, I think he's right. Go ahead, Robert.
Can I make just one point, Michael? I'd like to know what your response to this. I think, and I have encountered interesting elements of the military recently retired who are pro-Trump, because he will do this. All this, as you rightly say, Steve, in your wonderful line, they don't take him literally, but he is serious. He will deal with this. Hillary is a flake. She's a sellout. Look at the whole business. And what I fear is if just by some fluke he does become president, we could see what happened under George W. Bush, where two elements like Cheney and Rumsfeld, whoever their equivalent will be, grab the steering wheel, and you'll see the Petraeuses and all these other declared Republican, recently retired, Jack Keane, all piling in to run the show. And I think we could have very big global problems with that.
Very briefly, Michael.
I appreciate that, Robert, but I don't think he's going to win. I think the professionals in the Republican Party know the game is up. His troops, the 30-40% of the electorate that really support him, will be disappointed and bitterly so. And they'll find another candidate just like Trump.
Okay, we'll leave it there. I'm afraid we didn't have time for Iceland. but we'll have that tomorrow. Michael Goldfarb and Robert Fox, thank you both very much indeed. That's all we have time for on Midori House. It was produced by Ben Ryland. It was researched by Guy Lutz and Gal Barnier. The studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. We've got music next, then The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli and Monocle Daily at 2200. That's 1700 in New York. I'm Steve Bloomfield. That was Midori House. We're back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. Until then, thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.